Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it onto your iPod, iPad, or just on your computer and hit play. Today's show is pretty interesting because it's managing information is a hard thing to argue with in any capacity. It's just a good idea. But for companies who are sued, the pain of not managing information can be like feeling like someone who doesn't floss or brush their teeth gets when they go to the dentist, compounded by the fact that this dentist doesn't use Novocaine. It can be pretty painful. So given the different personalities and approaches that people have managing their own information, change of people, systems over time, the fact that we're all busy doing non-litigation tasks and working in companies makes this pain to some extent unavoidable. But there are some things that companies can do to lessen these pains, and we have a collection of experts on the show to talk about the tips that they have on good information governance and how that impacts e-discovery. So our guests for the show are, we have Anthony Diana, who's a litigation partner in the New York City office of Mayor Brown. Anthony is the co-leader of Mayor Brown's Electronic Discovery and Records Management Group. He's counseled large financial institutions, pharmaceutical companies, and manufacturers in all aspects of the discovery and management of electronic information, including development of policies and procedures for the preservation, collection, review, and production of electronically stored information, the development of data source catalogs, disclosures, and responses relating to electronically stored information, the remediation of large volumes of legacy data, paper and electronic, and the defense of electronic discovery procedures before federal regulators and the courts. He's the editor of the Electronic Discovery Desk Book, a treatise published by PLI, and co-author of 6 chapters in that treatise. He also frequently speaks on electronic discovery issues and has published numerous articles on this topic. Glad to have you on your first show here with us, Anthony. It's long overdue.
I'm glad to be here.
Okay. We also have Shannon Smith on the show, who's the Director of Information Governance and General Counsel at Globanet, where she manages a portfolio of e-discovery and compliance offerings, including services to support the industry-leading e-discovery platform that they use. She also consults directly with corporate legal teams to develop policies and processes to support information governance programs. She's an experienced attorney and brings an extensive knowledge of regulatory compliance, litigation readiness, and records management issues to her role. She's a member of a number of the industry thought leader groups, EDRM and Sedona Conference, and has contributed articles to a number of publications, including Corporate Counsel and Information Management. She's spoken to various groups regarding cloud technology, preservation processes, and reducing e-discovery costs. Shannon is also a certified e-discovery specialist and holds both a JD and MBA from Loyola Marymount University. And we're doing this show because of conversations with Shannon over a while, so thanks for throwing out the topic.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Our last guest has been on ESI Bytes before, Bruce Ratke. He's a litigation partner in the Chicago office of Vedder Price and chair of their records management, e-discovery, and data privacy group. Bruce regularly counsels private and public sector clients, including a Fortune 5 company, on all aspects of records and information management, including developing and implementing enterprise-wide records retention schedules and the defensible disposal of obsolete legacy data. He's written and spoken extensively on a variety of topics relating to records retention, email management, and e-discovery. His articles and comments have been featured in the Chicago Tribune, Review of Banking and Financial Services, and the Privacy and Data Security Law Journal. He also represents all industry sectors in connection with various privacy and data security issues, has assisted clients in responding to data security incidents, and conducted data privacy audits to identify potential privacy and data security issues. So, Bruce, glad to have you back.
Yeah, Carl, thank you for having me back.
So let's first go with the usual general question. I know, Bruce, you've answered this once before, but you can indulge us again. So starting with you, Shannon, and then Anthony, let us know how you first got started in electronic discovery.
Well, I got started in this space right out of law school, actually. I was serving as director of business development for Globanet, where we were regularly consulting with clients on information management solutions, technologies. And given my legal background, transition to the e-discovery space was sort of a natural progression, and I've been working in this industry for, nearly 10 years now.
Oh, that's a good story. A lot of us get trapped in here, but it sounds like this has been your path. Sorry.
Not forever.
Sorry,
but...
I'm usually brutally honest in reaction, so I'm sorry. Anyway, Anthony, how did you get trapped in the e-discovery?
Yes, well... I'm sort of in between. I think I probably started with me as an associate. I was always of the view that documents were important in litigation and investigations, and particularly finding the key documents in a case. So I started out sort of managing large document productions in the paper world, and it sort of quickly transitioned to the electronic world, and it quickly became my life.
Trapped.
Yes.
But it's fun. It's a Rubik's Cube. It's a really challenging space. So.
It is very challenging.
And Bruce, yourself?
Yeah, well, similar to what Anthony's experience, I was a litigator by training and still do litigation. And, you know, I guess my experience in the last 15 years has been helping clients, you know, sometimes good, sometimes bad in terms of producing electronic information in litigation and trying to get them ready and responding to e-discover requests. You know, it's one of the interesting things that, you know, that I love about the practice, and that is, yeah, you may be trapped, but it's an ever-evolving space that, you know, if we look back at where we were at 5 years ago, is much different than where we're at today. And, you know, who's to guess where we're going to be at in another 5 years? So, yeah, you're trapped, but it's an interesting trap.
Yep. So, well, let's now focus on the topic, which is leveraging information governance to optimize e-discovery. And so, Shannon, what are some key actions to take before litigation arises to limit the scope of preservation and collection efforts?
Well, that will certainly depend on the level of information governance maturity an organization has achieved. So if a company has a relatively immature information governance program, the most effective thing they can do is to limit preservation and collection efforts is to get their house in order, really. That may include developing a high-level data map so both IT and legal understand where data for various custodian lives. And that doesn't necessarily mean mapping an entire organization, but certainly both groups need to understand where they can find data for key custodians. So the result is narrowing the number of repositories or locations that will be targeted for both physical legal holds and collections. Now, for organizations that have a more developed information governance program and or greater resources, there are a number of activities that can help them limit their preservation and collection efforts. And those might include things like implementing a realistic, workable retention policy that users can follow, which would help reduce the overall corpus of data to be targeted. Leveraging technology like an archiving or content management solution to centralize unstructured data will help reduce, again, the number of repositories that need to be tapped for collections. Additionally, these types of technologies will also help effectuate the retention policy so that an organization isn't wholly reliant on custodians for carrying out the policies that they've set forth.
Okay, so it really can run the range of effort depending on the sophistication of the client. This next question is a hard one. I'm doing a whole podcast on it, so you've only got one question. Anthony, sorry for your first show to give you such a hard one, but you've got clients of different varying sophistication in how they manage your information. I imagine, in my experience, most people don't do a very good job of it anyway. It's just too complicated. So how much do you also, you got another party in this. You've got the adversary that's bringing the lawsuit. How much do you involve the other side in this process and sort of at what point?
It is a very complicated question. I think, and I don't think there's a right answer to this. I think what every organization has to do is balance the risks and costs associated with their preservation and collection efforts. I think Generally, I would say that if you're dealing with a regulator in an investigation, you would probably be, and I think my view is that you'd be more open about what you're doing because it shows that you're cooperating, and they often ask those questions, I think, and they're repeat. If they're regulating an entity, they probably should know about your IT infrastructure, how you manage information, what the burdens are, and the like. I think on a litigation, it becomes a little more difficult, and it really depends on sort of the strategy that you're going to be taking in the litigation. I think I would generally say if it's a big litigation that you know is going to last for many, many years and the chances of settlement are pretty small, that when you're looking at the risks and the costs, it may make sense to start a negotiation sooner rather than later with the other side in order to limit the scope of preservation. I think one of the things that people have to understand is, you know, I have organizations who are constantly complaining that they shouldn't have to preserve all this information, particularly if a lot of them are preserving on a custodial basis. You know, all information relating to a custodian is being preserved, whether it's an email archive, files, personal drives, whatever it is, that's the way they're placing the hold. The flip side of that is you can do it that way, but if you want to start limiting that, particularly if you want to limit the number of custodians or limit business lines or maybe even limit data sources, you run a risk if you do this without letting the other side know, because down the line, at a deposition, invariably something's going to come up where someone says a data is located somewhere, and if you haven't preserved it, you're going to get yourself in trouble. So I think it's really something that you should be talking to your organizations should be talking to their litigation counsel about up front in terms of what is the strategy of the case, where do we think where this is going to go, and how much are we going to preserve, and then given those costs, does it make sense to start in those negotiations? I think the key, most important thing is everything should be documented. So if you're taking steps to preserve and you're taking steps to collect data, just make sure it's documented. So regardless of what position you take, if you're ever questioned, you have some place to go. I think the biggest mistake I see is that it's not documented and people are trying to recreate 2-3 years down the line the decisions that were done 3 years ago, and it's almost impossible to do.
Yeah, no, that's true. So, Bruce, what role, if any, do you see the corporate records managers playing in this e-discovery process?
Carl, I think they play a critical but often overlooked role in the process, and it kind of caused me to think back of an incident that we were involved in a piece of litigation with a financial institution. And it was one of the first cases that our firm had with this institution that was involved in serial litigation. And as part of our process, we went and spoke to the records manager. And he said, you know, I'm really surprised that no one's ever talked to me because I know where all the bodies are buried. And, you know, this guy was an enormous help in terms of our getting ready to respond to e-discovery and helping us do that. And I think in terms of the role, the records manager could really be your guide in a repository of information itself about the information that the organization has accumulated. That is, what records do we have? You know, where are those records located at in terms of the various repositories or physical spaces? You know, who are the custodians? And then also, you know, do we have these records still? Have they been disposed of in accordance with, you know, the retention schedules, or if there's been some reason why that there's been an exception to that? That's good to know very, very early on. Also, you know, I think it's absolutely critical that the records manager receives a copy of the hold notice, because he or she is going to be instrumental in ensuring that those preservation obligations are met, so you don't run into spoliation issues later on down in the litigation. And then also, you know, when the litigation is terminated, you know, it's good to have the records manager know that the litigation hold has been lifted, but at that point, the records may not be disposed of simply because the litigation has concluded. There may be business and legal reasons why you need to keep those records. So, you know, the records manager is instrumental in getting you back onto your your normal record keeping practices. One other thing that I think again is often overlooked, and that is the records manager could be a really good resource, not only in terms of a shield but also a sword, particularly for the folks that don't do records and information management as you know, a core part of their practice. You know, go and talk to the records manager in terms of the other side's record keeping practices, and see if there's any holds, and if on the other side, and that may provide a strategic advantage that you can leverage in the litigation. Carl?
Yeah, that's interesting. So we talked a little bit about the record retention policy earlier on. So and you know, Anthony from the lawyer's perspective, and Shannon from the technologist, what are the essential elements of record retention policy?
Well, I think my view is that you have to understand what a record retention policy is, and most importantly, what a record is versus what a document is. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe you could name it not record retention, but document deletion policy, because I think that's the key, is you want to get rid of things. As much as you want to keep things that are important to your business and that may be regulatorily required, you also want to delete things that aren't. So I think that's one of the big things, is really defining clearly what a record is versus what a regular document is, and making that point clear. I think the other thing to keep in mind, and these are just some tips that I've seen over the years, is things like, you know, making it clear that email is not a record. Email could be a record, but you have to usually do something to make it a record. So if it's an important communication that was sent by email, usually it's a good idea to have something clear that they have to put it somewhere outside of the email infrastructure in order to make it a record and designate it as a record, because that's going to help you down the line when you want to delete email on a large scale. Also, things like making sure backup tapes, it's clear that backup tapes are for disaster recovery only, making it clear that, you know, certain areas you're not supposed to keep quote-unquote records, like hard drives, and make it clear that, you know, business records are not to be kept on hard drives. That helps you down the line if you're negotiating with the other side and say, look, you know, we don't have to collect from anyone's hard drive because no business records are supposed to be kept there. That doesn't always work, but at least it helps you. And then also things like personal devices and personal accounts, and making it clear within those policies that, you know, information kept on personal devices information kept on personal devices should not be business oriented, as well as any business records or business communication should not be done on personal accounts. They're nice demarcations to have in your policy, so that when you're talking to a regulator or a plaintiff, you can say clearly that your policies state this, and therefore you don't have to look there. Doesn't always work, but it's a helpful start.
Okay. And Shannon, I don't know if you have anything else to add to that, or.
Sure, I've got a few things to add. I think that depending on the level of sophistication of the organization, one of the things I would add to that is that key element has got to be simplicity, where the policy relies heavily on custodians to classify and retain data. So as Anthony pointed out, you've got to help them understand what's a record, what's not a record, and provide clear instructions on how records are meant to be retained. For those organizations that are, you know, more heavily regulated and have more complex policies, I would certainly recommend the use of technology or some sort of automation to help carry out those policies, to rely solely on your end users to carry out retention of complex retention schedules is not likely to be very successful. And I would suggest that you write these policies with the technology in mind. So, you know, if you've already got a retention policy in place and you're looking to use some technology to help carry it out, go back and revisit the policy and maybe rewrite it based on what the technology can do for you. And what I found in my experience is that typically requires consolidation of different record classifications, buckets, if you will, to help carry out those retention policies.
And you know, I just thought of something on that, Shannon. I don't want to forget. Do you think that this is a space where, you know, a lot of times the lawyer doesn't know what the technology is, so they have a process that they define, you know, for doing things, but, you know, this step of looking at the technology, because I'm finding that in the space I work in, the predictive coding space, that a lot of times people are trying to hash together these protocols, and they don't do the simple step of let's talk to the vendor and see if that can be done.
Yeah, I see that a lot. I see that a lot where the retention policy has been written in a legal vacuum, if you will, without a lot of communication or consideration with either the IT group or the manufacturer of the technology that's going to be used, if that's already been determined. So, yes, that is something I see pretty frequently.
So what about the importance of data mapping and classification to discovery? You know, since these are terms of art in the record governance field, and you might want to define them too.
Sure. So I guess data mapping really is simply the effort involved in documenting where data lives throughout an organization. So that would include details such as record types or document types, date ranges that are covered by a particular repository, custodians whose data resides in those repositories. And, you know, a data map can be as simple as a spreadsheet in some instances, or as complex as, you know, I've seen real-time solutions that track where employees are storing data at any given point in time. Obviously, those are much more costly and require a lot of resources to manage, but I have seen those in existence in really large organizations. Data classification is really the method of applying a label or a tag to a record that tells us more about it. So, for example, the record type, a contract, a meeting agenda, an HR record, or maybe even a security level, whether this information is public or sensitive or a certain level of confidentiality. And a record may have a single or multiple classifications, and these classifications essentially allow organizations to make decisions on how that data is to be handled. So, for example, if a contract has been classified as a construction contract, it will be then retained for X number of years. Or if a document has been classified as, say, a level 4 confidential record, it can only be accessed by certain organizational groups. So you get the picture. In terms of how important these elements are to discovery, data mapping and classification help streamline the effectiveness of identification, collection, search, and culling processes. So if a certain set of contracts are being requested as part of discovery and all of your data has been mapped and classified prior to the request, you can imagine that simply referring to that data map to understand where the records are stored would be pretty simple, and you could run a collection and search for just those contracts based on, you know, the classification applied. Another example where classification proves useful in discovery is around privilege. So rather than including records that have already been designated as potentially privileged in a data set where they'll likely be reviewed again for privilege, you can leverage classification and the tags that have been applied to remove those items from the corpus at the onset of collections and either sampled or just removed altogether.
So it seems to me like much of what you've got there would be sort of your structured data, what you know, what's there, and then the real big pain point is the unstructured stuff that's still floating around.
Yeah, and unstructured data is really where I think classification is most useful. And there are certainly technologies out there that help provide some structure around unstructured data. Like an archiving solution would centralize data from multiple repositories, so you could bring in email. You could bring in data from file shares. You could bring in data from SharePoint. And as it's being brought in, you can, either based on end user classification or based on a level of automation, you can assign some tags and categories. And that's really where you're getting the most bang for your buck is providing some structure around those typically unstructured data sources.
So, Bruce, so we've talked about a number of different ways to try to get your handle around, you know, getting rid of data intelligently and retaining it intelligently and how you map it and how you classify. Have you ever tried to litigate a case with a complex client without having these steps in place? And I'm sure there's an it depends and yes and no. What's the impact of not doing this if you've run into that?
Right. Well, you know, actually, Carl, it's kind of a tough question because I think everybody has their horror story or stories, you know, that you can kind of pull up. And in thinking about this, you know, quite a few, but you know, one of the, you know, kind of going back to the question of why you got involved in e-discovery is kind of one of the horror stories that has kind of kept with me for a long time. We were involved in a piece of litigation with a multinational client, and as a fairly young associate, I went and spoke to the GC about, you know, responding to e-discovery requests. It was a very early case. And I said, well, do you got a records retention schedule or records management plan? And he said, yes, and turned around and pulled out a nice thick schedule and gave it to me. And that schedule kind of really became the bane of all our existence because they hadn't implemented and fully implemented, and when they did, it was terribly inconsistent. And so, you know, the problem with not doing this and doing it right is that, you know, that case and a lot of other cases, what happens is you get sidetracked on various e-discovery related issues and you never really get to the merits of the case. I mean, the Zubilite case is a prime example of that, just one of many. Not only that, you know, obviously you're going to be increasing the size of the case. I mean, that's an obvious statement, but the kind of the less obvious impact of not doing this is you really jeopardize or could jeopardize your credibility with the court, and I think that's overlooked. I'll give you an example. So particularly in this case that we had, and that is we had gone through and produced a number of different sales records, and there was an issue about whether we had produced them all the records or not, and there was representations to the court and to the other side that we had, and we had gone through and made sure that everything had that we had was produced. Long story short is, it turns out that they had a number of different backup tapes, believe it or not, stuck in a closet, that likely had sales data in, quite a bit of sales data. So you can imagine the impact that had when we had to go to the other side and then eventually to the court to explain to them that, oh, guess what, we had found, you know, this huge cache of backup tapes that has storage data on it after we made repeated representations that we had provided all that stuff to them. So, you know, it was an unfortunate circumstance. We were able to kind of fix the problem, but, you know, I think that not having your house in order and thinking you might do, it has a real, you know, not only can jeopardize your case, but jeopardize your credibility. Carl?
Yeah, and my experience has been that it's almost like, when is that problem going to happen in a case? Because none of these cases ever go smoothly. There's always some muckiness in there somewhere with a surprise. So, so you know, Bruce sure shared some of the horror stories. Do you see some of the benefits, Shannon, of putting this information governance in place aside from efficient discovery? Because maybe there's an ROI here.
Certainly, I think for highly regulated industry, information governance enables organizations to comply with their regulatory mandates, and obviously there's some just hard dollar cost savings in avoidance of fines and other reprimands. But I really think the most overlooked benefit of a strong information governance program is probably improved productivity and improved strategic value of one's informational assets. So as organizations begin to implement and or grow their information governance programs, how they're able to access and more importantly use that data to make strategic decisions will also improve. And then there's the obvious costs on data storage. I mean, you can certainly, by implementing a strong information governance program, streamline your back-end storage costs on the IT side and perhaps reduce the number of resources that you're leveraging to actually get to that data when litigation hits. So if you've got an information governance program where you've got consistent, enforced retention policies in place, you're leveraging some level of data classification, that's certainly going to improve the process and reduce your overall costs around the resources involved to find that data and turn it over to the legal teams for further culling and review.
Okay, and our economy, large companies typically grow by acquisition. I imagine if your house is in order for litigation, your house is in order for M&A activity. And at some point, that's good for shareholders. And I can think of lots of good business reasons for this, the other part of it is getting rid of the junk. And you were talking about this earlier, Anthony, and I also want to talk to Bruce a little bit about this because a couple of years ago, I remember this was a very controversial thing to be talking about when it's safe to delete records. People were having a harder time with that. But it seems to me like it's becoming a little bit more acceptable. So what are sort of the general rules of record retention, and when do you think it's safe to start deleting?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the tide has turned, and I think there's a number of reasons for that. One is clearly the cost. I think people realize now that you just can't keep everything. I think there was a knee-jerk reaction, in part to the Federal Rules of Procedure and all these investigations going on. They didn't want to be on the front page of the New York Times because they deleted things or attempted to delete things. So people sort of tried to get down the lockdown mode and said, okay, we're just going to keep everything. And I think now people realize, number one, it's just too costly. I mean, the cost associated with keeping everything and the explosion of information, it's just too costly just in terms of managing it. As Shannon was saying, it just becomes hard to use. And then I think the other reality is when things like data privacy become a much more important aspect of our legal environment, not only overseas, but even in the U.S., where data breaches are there, and regulators are now saying it's not only important that you keep data, but also when you keep data that's customer information, you have to have all these special procedures around it to make sure it's safe. You can't do that if you're keeping everything. So I think that the tide has turned. I think people also realize that keeping data, particularly for many, many years, just opens them up to huge e-discovery costs, and not just e-discovery costs, but liability, because now you have an email from 6 years ago that was not elegantly worded, and that could cost you, tens of millions of dollars just because of that one email. So I think people are now thinking about, I think much more intelligently, what can we get rid of and what should we really be keeping? And I think that's the, in terms of what the general rule of record retention should be, is you should only keep what you need. And that could be what you're legally required to keep, which is probably going to be a very small percentage of what you actually have in terms of total information, unless you're a broker-dealer or something where the regs are such that you are keeping a lot of information. But I think for most organizations, it's a very small percentage of data that you actually have to keep for regulatory or legal reasons. And then you have your legal holds, which obviously imposes an obligation, and coming up with a procedure and a policy that's intelligent around legal holds, I think, is incredibly important, and make sure that they can be enforced in a way so that you can continue to delete. And then I think, the final piece of the puzzle is you have to get the business people on board, because they should have a seat at the table. This is not a legal and compliance and IT function. Business people have to have a seat at the table when you're dealing with this, because for business purposes, they may need data that's older than what you think they need it for. So I think it's important to make sure that it's consistent with your business goals, with appropriate pushback, and making sure that people understand the risks and costs associated with keeping everything. So for many, many years, or keeping all your email for 3 years versus 6 months. I mean, they're important decisions, but it's decisions that I think if you have sort of senior management or an organization involved, just making the right decision, I think, is the most important thing, and making sure that for your organization, and making sure that you understand why you're doing it, document the decisions, and then move forward. And then it just becomes a matter of implementing the policy. And it has to be a policy that you actually can implement. I wouldn't just put a policy there knowing that you can't implement it.
So, Bruce, just also curious if you think that deleting records is an indication of good records management. And Maybe you want to expand a little bit on some of the risk if you do it incorrectly.
Sure. Well, Carl, I think, you know, certainly disposing of records is a good indication of good records management. On the flip side, if you're not deleting records, then that certainly is a red flag. You know, I think part of the process of deleting the information that Anthony talked about is, you know, once you delete, part of that process needs to be an audit function. And again, that's often overlooked, but I think the reason why that needs to take place, an audit function needs to take place after the deletion, to number one, ensure that the records are in fact being deleted and being deleted in accordance with the schedule. And if there is a gap between the practice and what should be being done and what is actually being done, you need to figure out why. And that may be an indication of there's an issue, whether in terms of end users or process, that you can fix. And you can do that as part of kind of your normal process, that if anyone ever questions it, you can explain, you know, this is why we did it, not for any nefarious reasons, as to avoid having those records be part of litigation. And to kind of follow up, with a point that Shannon made in terms of the, you know, kind of the benefits of doing that, of deleting it, we had done a study a while ago that showed that it's about $2 per email to locate, produce, or to locate, to preserve, to call through, and for the attorneys to review and eventually produce to the other side. $2 an email. So if you think about getting rid of the vast majority of emails that your organization has collected, if you can save $2 an email, that's a significant savings, and demonstrates really you're doing what you need to do. And also to kind of follow up on one of Anthony's points, why that, you know, deletion is good records management, and it goes to data privacy. And a couple points to that. Number one is, you know, under the EU laws, you are required to dispose of information once that information has served the purpose for which it has been collected. So the failure to dispose of those records may subject you to some issues in terms of EU and your safe harbor obligations. Secondly, having that information that it is no longer useful just makes that a risk. Having that information without serving its purpose is all it is doing is just making it available for someone to go in to get access to that information, whether inadvertently or you know, purposefully. So getting rid of that when you can reduces your risk in terms of data privacy.
So I hate when I read questions that I wish I'd rephrased earlier, you know. First, second, this could have been, if I had done this correctly, I've asked you both Bruce and Anthony's question this way before I asked Shannon. But, you know, my sense is, given the recent talks that have been happening for the last year about on amending the federal rules for preservation and or defining the culpable conduct before spoliation occurs, that there now has been a lot of talk about this burden of so much data and some of the challenges. So from my perspective, you know, so rather than asking you, I'll say that from what I hear in your answers, this environment of now we got to manage it better and delete it is really now coming to roost a little bit better. So with that in mind, Shannon, are you seeing from a technologist perspective that there's more data being deleted now, that it's definitely becoming, it's actually happening?
Yeah, I definitely have noted, probably particularly in the last, say, 18 or 24 months alone. I mean, I remember going into client meetings, and if you'd ask about their retention policy, they'd say our retention policy is we keep everything forever. And that's becoming less frequently a response from our clients. I think that given the standards, that the standards for preservation have been pretty well defined by the courts, you know, many organizations are finally taking steps to put technology in place to help carry out their legal hold obligations. And I think once these obligations are just codified, the stragglers who have yet to act will really be forced to start to actively manage their data. And by that, I mean start to assign some retention and carry out those policies so that they're purging what is no longer required by the business, either for business purposes or for, regulatory requirements.
You know, it's sort of amazing. I had another thought hit my mind here while we're talking about this. I remember back at Georgetown the previous year, this big debate about, I think it was during the discussion of the amending the federal rules on the judges were saying, well, why don't you just get rid of it and not preserve as broadly? And the audience was saying, well, because we're scared. You know, if we make a mistake, we're going to get slammed. And it seems to me that the marketplace now is already starting to do this, and we're still in the argument of the rules, and I think something will come out. But as you said, Shannon, there are people waiting, and there are people that have said we're gonna do it because people are talking about it now, it makes common sense. So it's amazing to watch the rules process occurring, and it may be now that the rules are behind where the market is, that it's already happening.
Right.
But which is just I always find it interesting when you see an example like that. But this may be one of those situations. So the other part of the debate was getting slapped on the wrist or worse, spoliation charges. And I'll ask this to both you, Anthony, and to Bruce. First, to Bruce, are you seeing the climate for spoliation becoming less? I don't want to say less worrisome, but maybe less worrisome. That there's better understanding of how difficult this is, or is it still very scary stuff?
Well, you know, that's a tough question because I think that.
Sorry.
No. You get. You know, certainly the trend in spoliation has continued to increase on those number of cases, and I also think that there's a, you know, the increased judicial expectations, right? I harken back to a decision out of the District Court of Utah back in 2009, Philip Adams versus Dell, in which Dell Computer, you know, high-tech company was sanctioned for its questionable information management practices. And one of the things that the court noted was it lacked a records retention program and the technology to manage the organization's records. Probably it's a function of, you know, who the defendant was, but the court held that, you know, the absence of a coherent document retention policy is a pertinent factor to consider when evaluating sanctions. Information management policies are not a dark or novel art. So that was back in 2009. Fast forward to 2012, and, you know, I think you continue to see, heightened judicial expectations on the litigants, but at the same time, and this is why it's kind of hard, a recognition that this isn't easy as just pushing a button.
It may just be there's more e-discovery cases now coming through the pipeline, too.
Yeah, exactly. And
who knows?
Yeah, in various different forms, right? And I guess the thought is, and kind of tying up some of the other threads that we've been throwing around here. I mean, if you know, what I always tell folks, you know, you given the complexities, this is never going to be a perfect process. You're going to have bumps in the road. So the thought, given that recognition, that you want to get your house in order, you want to demonstrate all of the good faith efforts that you undertook before litigation started and throughout litigation to avoid having the missteps. And if you do have a misstep, what you're doing is you're creating a very good story, right? And arming your counsel such that when they are facing a spoliation motion, you can go before the court and say, look, here's everything that we did in order to avoid this from happening, but unfortunately it did happen. You know, certainly no guarantees that you're not going to get adverse ruling, but you're certainly going to increase the chances that that would not have if you weren't able to present such a good story.
Okay. And are you seeing sort of similar things, Anthony, from your perspective, that the market climate is changing, or?
Yeah, I think it is. I think one of the things that I like to tell people is that, I think it worries lawyers, but they have to understand this, is every day data is being deleted within your organization. And, you know, as an outside counsel, you have to understand that every day, and whoever you're representing, data is being deleted. It's just happening. Because you cannot have complete control over everything. And in some ways, technology is limited. I mean, I think, you know, people view, well, it's all going into an archive. Well, you know, if you really push the technologists and say, okay, does that archive 100%? No. It's not archiving everything. There's a lot of corrupt data in there, just like backup tapes have corrupt data. There's corrupt data everywhere. So it's not 100% anyway. And even though, you know, you read these cases and, you know, even like Judge Shindlin and others, they always talk about it's reasonable steps, it's not perfection, but everyone shoots for perfection because they're all terrified that they're going to be viewed or whatever they did wasn't reasonable. And I think that is one of the things that's changing. I think most people now are focusing, and this goes not only for sort of the records management side, but even in terms of e-discovery, is I think there's a focus now on prioritization, and that, you know, when you have a case, it is far better to focus on the key custodians, the key people who have the key data, than trying to get everybody. So it's much better to say, okay, here are the 10 people or 20 people that we probably are going to be deposed, or the 5 people are going to be deposed. Let's do everything we can for those people. But for the 20 or 30 or others that we don't, you know, are peripheral, we're not going to do as much. I think that's, you know, it's just being smarter, because you're not going to get 50, 60 people done correctly. You're not going to want to put the resources in there. So I think in terms of spoliation, and that's, I think, where the federal rules are going too, it's, you know, the stuff should be material. Just because a custodian lost their hard drive and they were, you know, they were supposed to be preserved because they were number 99 on a list of 100, doesn't mean that that person should be sanctioned or that organization should be sanctioned. It should be, you know, was it material? If it was one of the key people, if it's your CEO and there's a matter that the CEO is important on, then it does matter. So I think that's where it's changing, is people are now really focusing on where are the risks and applying the money to the risks, as opposed to trying to throw money and resources to eliminate all the risk. It's really just mitigating the key risks and then, you know, living with some of the other risks that are out there.
Okay. So the last question is, you know, I'd sort of like to go around to all you guys on this topic, your best tip for achieving effective information governance. And we can start with Shannon and then Anthony and then Bruce. You get the hardest spot of following the first two answers. So go ahead, Shannon. You got the easy spot.
All right. Well, I think my tip would be to tackle information governance incrementally rather than attempting to boil the ocean. I know that there's technology out there that claims to be the end-all, be-all. It will solve all your information governance program. And I can't tell you, and I know this is probably true of all the panelists here, how many times I've heard the phrase, you know, end-to-end e-discovery platform can solve all your organization's problems. So I say start with the fundamentals, a basic data map, a sound retention policy, and then start to examine technologies that will help you automate some of the workload around classification, assignment of those retention policies, and deletion. I think Anthony mentioned that earlier. Deletion is really key as part of this conversation. And when you're looking at exploring technologies around information governance, you know, make sure that you're looking at vendors that can provide integration. So if you've got an e-discovery platform, how does that tie into your archiving platform? And as you all know, you know, technology is never perfect. The vendors will probably never deliver on all their promises that they made during the sales process, but certainly look for those key integration points between the different technologies and solutions that you're...
Bruce is going to hate me if I let you give a third tip.
Right, okay,
That's right, Carl.
Anthony, what's your tip if you want to add to that?
Sure. No, the tip, it's sort of similar to this, is in terms of prioritization. And the idea of when you're starting out and figuring out your information governance, focus on the highest risk, highest value information first, and figure out what that is in your organization and make sure that's being effectively managed, and sort of build out from there. So consistent with what Shannon said in terms of, you know, don't try to tackle everything. I think besides doing it incrementally in terms of policy and then getting to the and procedures before you get to the technology, I think it's also crucial that you think about what is the most important information in your organization and work from there. So, you know, I think of things like don't archive everybody. If you're going to do an email archive, maybe you should just archive a small segment that has the higher risk. And things like that really make a huge difference in terms of managing your information.
Okay, now Bruce, you got anything left here?
I do. I mean, and I think Shannon and Anthony had great points, and just kind of to further develop these, you know, I think a lot of times folks feel records and information management and e-discovery is such a monumental task that they're, you know, the pursuit of perfection prevents them from doing anything. So, you know, yes, there is a lot of things to do, but you know, you need to do something and do something now. And don't let the notion that we have to be perfect stop you from undertaking those tasks today. You know, as Anthony said, you need to develop, you know, tackle the high-risk records, but at the same time, you also need to have a more global approach of, all right, you know, let's begin to eat the elephant in incremental steps, but at the same time, we need to have a broader view of figuring out we need to go from A to Z and build out that roadmap to get there. And the reason for that is you're not going to be able to just flip on a switch. And, you know, this is a process, and your information management practices may be questioned in the middle of the process, to which you're going to be able to say, look, you know what, we are at step C, but we've got step Z worked out in the process, and we're moving toward that. And again, it's this whole notion that, you know, you want to prevent the best story to the regulators or to the court. So do something now, you know, do something, get some high wins right away, and yet give some thought as to globally, what is our strategy going to look like, and how are we going to get there?
Okay. Now, the last question I like to ask on the podcast on most of the shows is, and this helps me, it might be our next podcast, is what you see here today on September 21st, 2012, the issue from your perspective is the biggest issue in the e-discovery field, and this is your chance to get back at Shannon, everyone. We'll start with you, Bruce, then Anthony, then Shannon. Maybe there's something left in e-discovery. I don't think you're in a dangerous position here. So, Bruce, what's your biggest issue you see out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a very long time we have seen this growing trend that the, you know, kind of the left side and the right side of the EDRM model is somewhat melding, and I think that is going to continue to increase pace, you know, so that e-discovery becomes, let's hope, becomes part of good records and information management along with data privacy. So, you know, rather than more of a siloed approach, what you're probably going to see is more in terms of information governance, and that's going to deal with records and information management, e-discovery preparedness and response, and data privacy all in one. And I think it's absolutely critical to look at how you're managing information much more globally than what we have in the past, rather than kind of look at various point solutions.
Okay, Anthony?
Yeah, I think similar to Bruce, I would just focus particularly on data privacy and really just managing information even in the course of litigation. I think a lot of the rules that are applied in terms of managing information, whether it's the sensitive assets of a corporation or whether it's data that's subject to various regulations for data privacy reasons, when that is, you know, sent to the law firm, sent to the discovery vendor, and then sent to the plaintiffs or the regulators, I think there's been too little attention paid to that, and I think people are starting to pay attention to that and realizing how difficult it is to continue to manage information once it's outside of the organization. And you see this, it's a similar issue in terms of when you have personal devices and the like, where the information is now outside of the organization's control, but they still have the obligations to manage it.
Yeah, I remember Georgetown last year. That was probably the best presentation I saw the entire time. That had everyone's the hair on their neck prickling.
Yep.
It was this big discussion on data privacy and all the data floating around there. And I've you know, this points out my problems, my ESI bites. I have had this show ready to do for a year with people I want to do it, and I just can't get to it. It's such a great topic, though. It's scary stuff.
It is very scary.
So,
and if you talk to a data privacy professional, they die when they hear how people litigate and turn over information.
Yeah,
they are shocked at how we treat information.
But look at the younger kids and all the stuff they put on Facebook.
Yeah,
and Congress
too.
People, you know, it's sometimes. So you know, but you know, third issue, Shannon, now it's your time, and I think there's a lot out there for you to point to. So go ahead. What do you think?
I'd say that one of the trends that I think is really kind of leading right now in terms of e-discovery hot topics is the use of technology as part of the review effort and leveraging things like computer-assisted review or predictive coding or whatever you want to call it to codify or look at the decisions that humans are making, that attorneys are making, and leveraging the technology to transpose that on a larger data set. And I think that's probably, I see a lot of large law firms starting to dip their toe in that pool and leverage that technology just kind of in an exploratory fashion on certain cases. But I think, you know, over the next couple of years, we're going to see that used more widely and all, of course, the case law that's going to come along with it.
Yeah, my bias is there, but I like that answer. Anyway, good stuff. I want to thank all three of you for joining us here, Shannon, Anthony, and Bruce at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have guests such as yourself share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. I'd like to thank my friend and sponsor, the people over at Chernoff, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. You can remember the show phonetically. It sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come back to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day. And